So my name is Edward Oakes, and I'll be telling you about rapid task provisioning with serverless optimized containers, or SOC. This is some work that I did at the University of Wisconsin-Madison with my fellow students Leon, Dennis, and Kevin. Tyler, who is a researcher at Microsoft, and professors Andrea and Remzi Arpachi-Dussault. So before we talk about serverless at all, we really need to understand the greater trend that really led up to it, which is this increased focus on increasing developer velocity. This has manifested itself in a few different ways. The first of these trends is that developers are more and more often reaching for high-level programming languages that allow them to rapidly develop working code. So we've seen this in the explosive rise of Python over the last few years, and also the popularity of JavaScript, even on the back end with things like Node.js. And alongside using these high-level languages, developers are also more and more using pre-written packages. So there's this extensive package support. We see hundreds of thousands of modules in each of these repositories, and developers often like to use these packages instead of writing everything from scratch themselves. And finally, the architectural culmination of this trend has been this movement towards the microservices architecture. So microservices architecture dictates that you decouple previously monolithic distributed applications into modular pieces or services. And then because each one of these services is logically simple and more lightweight, they can be developed, tested, and deployed much more rapidly. And they can also be deployed independently, meaning we can scale only the pieces of our application that we need to. So recognizing this trend towards increased developer velocity and also this idea of microservices architecture, cloud providers have come up with these new offerings called serverless computing. So the idea with this is it functions as a service. So the developer only needs to upload their actual application code, and the platform handles all deployment, scaling, and provisioning of the runtime. There's some really awesome benefits that you can get from this model. For example, you get true auto-scaling that doesn't need to be configured at all. The platform just spins up more invocations when you need to scale. There's also massive on-demand parallelism, which has led to these new serverless native applications. And because serverless is pay-as-you-go, meaning you only pay for the actual time that your application is running, there can be some really tremendous cost savings as well. But from the platform perspective, in order to actually realize these benefits for the users, there's this significant hurdle that they have to overcome, which is how can you deploy, isolate, and start runtimes for these applications on the order of milliseconds? So this is the problem that is central in SOC. And to understand it a little bit more, we need to dig into the serverless runtime. So basically, the serverless runtime is shared hardware, operating system, and server, and then we have these deployment bundles, which minimally consist of basically isolation mechanism, which is a container, and then the high-level language runtime, like a Python interpreter. So even just from this like bare-bones runtime, we already see almost 450 milliseconds of startup cost, meaning that we're already far above our target for the platform of being able to start these things in just a few milliseconds. And when you combine this with the fact that developers are using these pre-written packages, which can oftentimes be quite costly, taking seconds to download and install and up to 100 milliseconds to import, the runtime has to do significant work all before any application code is actually run. What this means is that what platforms are actually doing is keeping these runtimes idle in the background. So from the developer perspective, you're seeing these really cool benefits of serverless, but the runtime is actually just eating that cost. So our solution with SOC is threefold. The first is we precisely understand and measure existing Linux isolation mechanisms that make up containers. And we optimize them for the serverless workload, which leads to 18 times faster create and destroy lifecycle over Docker containers. We also provision new runtimes from zygote processes, which is an idea that originally came out of the Android operating system. And this allows us to provision new runtimes 3 times faster than we can using just serverless optimized containers alone. And finally, we cache the execution across a 3-tiered cache, And this allows us to reuse initialization work with both the runtime and packages across different customers. And all in, this gives us 3 to 16 times speed up in platform cost, or the time it takes the platform to start the runtime in a image processing case study. And this is all part of a greater project at the University of Wisconsin called Open Lambda, and I encourage you to check it out on GitHub if you're interested. So for the rest of the talk, I'll talk about each of these three contributions in serial, and we'll evaluate each one as we go along. Before getting into our work on serverless optimized containers, I want to talk a little bit more about the anatomy of a Linux container. So when people think about Linux containers, they often have this single isolation mechanism that's sort of like a cheaper VM in mind. But in reality, it's actually quite different. We're not virtualizing the hardware. Instead, what we're doing is virtualizing access to kernel resources. And the mechanisms that we use to virtualize this access can roughly be grouped into three separate groups. So there's the file system, and then we have namespaces, which isolate resource access, and cgroups, which isolate resource usage. So container file systems are often built on top of union file systems, which means they consist of some set of read-only layers, and then a writable layer on top. So for example, a container image will also often start with a base image like the Ubuntu root file system, and then we might install some packages on top of it in another layer. We then make that read-only, and on top of it, we actually build our application. And when all is said and done, we have this read-only set of layers, which the combination of them contains everything that we need to run our application. Then at runtime, we can run multiple copies of the same container, sharing this read-only image with just a thin writable layer on top of it. So how do we actually prevent processes in different containers from interacting with the same resources? The way that we do this is using namespaces. So there are 7 individual namespaces, and each one of these isolates a different set of resources in the Linux kernel, and they can be used either independently or in conjunction with one another. So we'll go through an example of typical namespace use, which is the mount namespace. So here we have a single process, which is running on the host, and you can see its view of the root file system. And what we want is we want a second process that's running in a container, which has my image, which is a container base image as its root file system. So what we do is fork off of this parent process, and now by default this new process points to the same mount namespace underneath, which means that they have a consistent view of the file system. Then if we make an unshare system call, which creates a new mount namespace, it basically clones the namespace, and it now has its process 2 now has its own copy, although they're still the same. We can then modify process 2's mount points using calls like unmount, mount, and pivot root to remount our base container image as the root mount point of the container file system without modifying process 1 or the host processes. And this is just the mount namespace, but you can imagine we go through similar operations for the other namespaces, and the culmination of these is a container. And so finally, where namespaces isolate resource access, control groups or C groups isolate usage. So this means we can limit the amount of memory, for example, that a container uses, or we can prioritize packets from one container over another. And these basically just allow us to prevent one container from consuming too many resources. So basically, when you put all this together, you have this long laundry list of operations, some of which are related to each other, and you have to do all of these before you actually run any of the user code. So all of a sudden, the 400 milliseconds to start a Docker container doesn't actually seem so unreasonable. So in our work on SOC, we recognize that containers aren't just a single cohesive abstraction, and we ask two guiding questions in order to optimize them for serverless. The first is, what are the actual costs or implications of using each one of these components that makes up a container? And the second is, what are the actual requirements for serverless workloads? Because if we can marry the answer of these two questions, we can come up with something that's both performant and meets the requirements. So returning to our example of mounting, we perform a simple example of, a simple experiment to understand the performance of AUFS, which is a union file system like the one described earlier, versus the simpler bind mounting. And we do this at varying levels of parallelism. And we find that bind mounting is significantly faster than mounting a union file system layer, and it also scales much better at high levels of concurrency. We can actually mount and unmount bind mounts about 3 times faster at high levels of concurrency. So do we actually need this this complicated mechanism of read-only and writable layers for serverless application containers? Well, serverless applications are by nature transient, and because they're more logically simple, we don't actually need this full operating system view that's meant to support like multiple different diverse processes running. Really, all that we need is some writable scratch space and access to the libraries that our application depends on. So this means that we can replace the flexible and expensive union file system and mount namespace operations with simpler, faster, cheaper bind mounts and a ch root call. So this is the general pattern that we follow in serverless optimized containers, and we analyze more of these components in depth in the paper. I encourage you to read about it. And the basic idea is that the serverless runtime is constrained, and we can use this to our advantage if we really understand the individual isolation mechanisms. And here's some more examples of the optimizations that we do. So to understand how much performance improvement we actually get from these optimized containers, we perform a simple experiment, which is we compare running no-op handlers, which means these are invocations that just return as soon as they're started up. And we do this in OpenLambda, comparing using Docker containers versus SOC for isolation. So as we can see from the results, SOC is significantly faster at all levels of concurrency. So it only takes about 100 milliseconds to start a SOC container when you're doing it in serial, and it scales very well to high levels of concurrency. So we're actually able to create and destroy containers about 18 times faster with SOC than with Docker. So moving on to our generalized zygotes. So zygotes were initially developed for the Android operating system. And in this scenario, you have many Android applications that all depend on the same common system libraries. And because they all redundantly import these same libraries, you take up a lot of unnecessary space in memory, which is especially important in the mobile environment. So the solution was to start this zygote at initialization time, which imports all of these common system libraries. And then when we provision new applications, we actually fork from the zygote instead of starting from scratch. So we get low latency access to these libraries and also get the benefits of copy-on-write memory to reduce redundancy. So if we can generalize this idea to our serverless environment, then we'll be able to basically eliminate the cost of starting up the language interpreter and also the initialization cost for different packages. And because of the copy-on-write benefits, we'll also be able to pack more of these serverless handlers into memory on a given machine. But this is also a little bit more difficult than it is in the Android situation because we actually can't trust any of these libraries because Python packages can basically run arbitrary code when they're imported. So this means that we need to be able to create new zygotes on the fly that have different combinations of packages, and we want to do it in response to the requests that are actually coming in real time. So the implementation details to fulfill these constraints are actually pretty complex. I'm not going to go through them right now, but if you're interested, I encourage you to read about that. So to understand how much this zygote provisioning helps over just starting runtimes from scratch, perform an experiment where we just create and destroy empty runtimes for handlers. So that's just the container and the interpreter needed to run them. And we do this as fast as we can at multiple levels of parallelism. So here we compare OpenLambda running Docker to OpenLambda running SOC, and then OpenLambda running SOC and using the zygote provisioning strategy. So basically provisioning from a zygote is significantly faster and also scales much better. And we're able to provision about 3 times more runtimes per second when using the zygote over just serverless optimized containers alone. So finally, moving on to serverless caching. The idea here is we want to be able to cache initialization work across 3 different tiers. The first of these tiers is what we call the handler cache. So this is the idea that while each handler needs to be isolated from other handlers, we can reuse these initialized runtimes for requests to the same lambda over time. So what we do is when a handler request finishes running, we pause it using the freezer C group interface, and then we unpause it, which is a very fast, just like 3 millisecond call, and then we can run without provisioning a new runtime. The import cache is using a dynamic set of the zygotes that we discussed earlier between different lambdas. And finally, the install cache allows us to reuse installed packages between lambdas. To illustrate what these look like in practice, I'll go through a short example of the handler and import caches. So say we start with this empty state of an empty handler cache and an import cache that just has one zygote with no packages. If we have a request to handler 1, which depends on package A, then we provision a new zygote, forking off of this root zygote, and then we provision a new handler process from that, relocate it to a handler container, and serve requests. Then if we have a second request to the same handler, we bypass the import cache altogether and just serve from the existing runtime. If we have a request come in for a second handler that depends on packages A and B, well, in this case, we can reuse the initialization work for package A, provision a new zygote by only initializing package B in it, and then once again relocate its child and serve requests. And an interesting case happens if we have a third request come in for a handler which depends only on package B. So in this case, we're tempted to use this entry that has packages A and B imported because we wouldn't have to do any initialization work. But there's still the question of what if package A in this case is malicious? Well, we don't want to expose handler 3 to this malicious package if it didn't explicitly depend on it. So this leads to a pretty interesting cache entry selection policy that we call the subset only rule, which means that for a given handler, you can only use a zygote process that has a strict subset of the packages it requires. Digging a little deeper into what the interaction between these two caches looks like, take this example where we have 8 different handlers all importing the same package, Django. So each of these boxes represents the memory footprint of one handler, where the blue area is Django-specific memory and the gray area is handler-specific memory. So as is, we can only fit 4 of these into the cache. But if you consider the case that we had actually provisioned these from a zygote process, well, in this case, all of this Django memory would have been copy on write. So assuming that handlers didn't write to the package in memory, then the memory footprint of each handler effectively shrinks to only the handler-specific memory, meaning that we'll have a higher hit rate to the cache. And that's on top of the fact that when we do have misses to the cache, it'll still be faster to provision a new handler. So to understand how these caching layers actually impact request latency, we perform a simple experiment where we just send 2 random requests per second to a single open lambda worker machine, and these requests are randomly sent to 100 different lambdas, but they all import the same Django package. So here we have a CDF of the latencies for 4 different caching conditions for this experiment. So all the way on the right, we have no caching. So in this case, we have to go through the full initialization work for the package each time we provision a runtime. So it takes multiple seconds to start up. To the left of that, we have the handler cache only. So in this case, you can see about 20% of requests had 5 millisecond latency, meaning they were hits to this handler cache, but the rest missed and had to go through the full initialization work and took the few second latency. And then to the left of that, we have the import cache. In this case, we could provision from a zygote. So we have a consistent around 20 millisecond latency for every request. And then finally, when we have both enabled, we were actually able to pack more of these handlers into the cache. So we have a near 100% hit rate, and our latency stays around 5 milliseconds. So in conclusion, we've really seen this evolution over time, where initially we had personal computers or servers that ran many different processes, and they all competed for resources. We then moved to running multiple VMs on a host, where we had monolithic applications, maybe just one or a few of them per host. And more recently, we've seen this trend towards containers that are running just really small pieces of applications that are stitched together into a full distributed application. So the question is, what comes next? And I'm not sure how to answer that, but I can definitely see a clear trend here. And it begs this question, which is, as a systems community, how can we support running small and distributed pieces of code more quickly, more easily, and more securely? So in this work, what we did to address this is carefully measured and used the existing abstractions. But in future systems, really we need to more fundamentally reevaluate how these are designed so that we can support these transient workloads. Thank you.
So with the cache in particular, I'm curious about the reuse of handlers. What are the security implications of that? Did you do any investigation in that where you could have one particular handler, but because the transactions, the different requests that are being processed on it, is there a risk of contamination between those requests where you wouldn't have that if you didn't have the cache and you basically built the entire thing?
So maybe I wasn't 100% clear. So that cache is only for like requests to the same exact Lambda, but they're repeated requests over time. So basically the guarantee is, there's no guarantee that you have any state. So you can reuse the same container and there aren't security implications because it's to the same Lambda. So basically if you had done something to your container and then you request it again, then that's basically on you. Does that answer the question?
Hi, Dan Williams, IBM. That was a great talk. So I had a question about the type of applications that are running. So you presented mainly Python, and I would guess it would be very similar for something like Node.js.
Yeah.
But there's this sort of trend towards making containers with very, you know, kind of stripped down containers, and people use things like Go for that. And I was wondering how many of your techniques would apply in that kind of world.
Yeah, so our focus here was really on the like the higher level languages, especially ones that have like dynamic runtime. I think that's sort of like a totally different approach. And our work here is to put the fewest constraints that we can on the developers that are already reaching for these high level languages. But yeah, seeing if we can extend it to like statically linked languages is interesting in the future.
All right.
Go ahead. That's right. There's a small question. Why not use the checkpoint and restore feature of Linux to simplify the startup? Because you probably, instead of having some cold copy of servers, easier to just starting it, because around 15 years ago when we developed the Virtuoso technology, which is doing exactly the same, we found that this initialization can be avoided. But since that, we have now the ability to just making a snapshot of the container memory, not in the VM world.
Sure, so the checkpoint and restore is basically what's happening with the pause, unpause. Are you saying, I'm not sure I quite understand. You're saying to checkpoint and then just deploy the checkpointed memory state?
Checkpointing the basic server, and then when you need it, restore it from the, it's a much lighter way than just doing the creative for use cache of servers.
Yeah, so I think you would lose some of the benefits that we get from sharing initialization across different lambdas, but for an individual one, that's a good idea. We should definitely think about that in the future.